Oh, hey there, listeners and juicers. Before we get into today's episode, I wanted to let you know that if you have fallen in love with the Draw Your Dice podcast and want to help put some new fruit on the table, but don't feel comfortable making a monthly commitment, well, you can support the show via the Acast supporter feature. No gift too large, nor too small. Just click on the link in the show description and know that I am sending you the strongest hug when you do so.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Iteration is how you get good at things and create good things, because your first iteration is bad. First drafts are bad, usually, in my experience.
My name is Jeremy Gage, and welcome to the Draw Your Dice podcast. This is an educational show involving all things tabletop role-playing industry. Listen alongside me as we hear from creators, entrepreneurs, and supporters about their personal best practices, principles, and philosophies. I encourage anyone from the budding game designer to a seasoned publisher and everyone in between to sit down with us and enjoy today's episode. Hello, everyone. Thank you for coming to the Draw Your Dice podcast. My name is Jeremy Gage, as you heard in the intro. But as always, the show is never about me. It is about who I have brought to you today. And who I have brought to you today is maybe self-proclaimed number one fan of the show. I don't know. They've been binging it since they found it in the course of a couple months. They are a LARP designer. They are a game designer or a tabletop game designer, because those things should be separate but also inclusive. Anyways, let's welcome to the show Eric Faber.
And the crowd goes wild. Hello, Jeremy.
Hello, Eric. Thank you for being here today.
Thanks for having me. This is an honor.
Oh, God.
A dream of mine I've had for a month and a half.
Yes, I saw the tweet. Ever since I saw the tweet of get me on there, I said, we're going to get Eric on there. Goes to show, I read the tweets.
Tweet at the show. If you're a game designer listening to this podcast and you want to be on it, just tweet at Jeremy, because you can't ignore it.
Eric, would you give a brief introduction of who you are and how you present yourself to the internet for folks who may not be aware of who you are?
Yeah, my name is Eric Faber. I am a game designer from way up north, up on Lake Superior. I'm at Eric at Airborne Ham on Twitter and airborneham.itch.io on itch. You can find my games there. I've got a couple of games on itch these days. I've been making board games and stuff and tabletop RPGs now.
Woo! Woo! So many things. As an additional icebreaker for the show per every episode, Eric, would you also just give a brief lineage of your experience in the tabletop space, sort of like what was the first game that got you into the hobby, and then what was maybe the first sort of experience that got you to start designing games as well?
Yeah, so my first tabletop role-playing game was, I guess, also the first game I designed, sort of. Ooh. in seventh grade in study hall. My friends and I were playing, I forget who, somebody brought it. It was basically, you had a map that was hand-drawn of a fantasy landscape. I think Oblivion was big at the time. And we somebody's older sibling had played D&D and they found out about that and brought roll a D6 and we find out what happens. One person's the GM, but we didn't call it that. And you just sort of told a story. We didn't have stats or anything. We had a piece of paper with all of your inventory that you picked up along the way. And we just sort of took turns, free flow, GM character storytelling in a seventh grader's version of Oblivion. And we played that for years in study halls through seventh and eighth grade and into high school. I still have, I ended up making like massive maps that I hand drew with each individual tree drawn in pencil of these Amazing. Huge maps that I made. And I still have them in a folder somewhere. I found them when I moved. And we was roll a D6 and sixes are good and ones are bad. And that was the game we played. And so, and I just GM'd that for 3 years in my formative years before in high school, we kind of stumbled into actual Dungeons and Dragons and the 8 hour long basement sessions with Mountain Dew and two combats. And it wasn't really until just as I, like my senior year of high school, there was a guy at my local game shop who wrote his own game called Cityscape. It was a cyberpunk game, and it was basically a D&D clone also, but it was got a bunch of unique tech in it. And he kind of introduced me to the idea of like, yeah, you can just make your own games. And so we played that for a while, and I ended up taking that D20 class system and making my own like 1920s mobster game out of it that never Ooh. Got past just classes and stats and abilities. But that I put a lot of work into over the summer 1 year. And then I found, as I was going to college, I found World of Darkness, like just the core World of Darkness book. And that sort of opened me up to the fact that there are published games out there that are like not just fantasy, because I'm pretty over fantasy. So I've played World of Darkness and I played Savage Worlds. And when I came back from college and stayed in my hometown again, I got a new group together. I got of some of my old friends that were still in the area, and we started doing weekly RPG nights. And that was probably about 6 years ago. Every Wednesday night, we meet and we play an RPG, and our goal was basically we're going to play not D&D. And we have done that successfully since. I think I've played Dungeons & Dragons 5th edition twice since high school, or since it got that released. And and then that group of people, I met the people who were running Haunted Mansion, the LARP that I ended up stumbling into running for 3 years. They were running Haunted Mansion at the local college, which was basically just a building was taken over by students playing a hidden role game with goals. Mm-hmm. And when that generation of kids graduated, it stopped happening, and we kind of took it out of the college and into our local town. And I ran that for 3 years. And I dabbled in board game design, but that's a nightmare to get into. That is a very big barrier of entry. And then I've been working on tabletop RPGs and other games on the side. But yeah, Haunted Mansion for the past 3 years until COVID happened 2 years ago. Mm-hmm. And then we stopped.
Good.
I haven't done much for the past couple of years. That was long and rambly, but yeah, that's my origin story, I guess.
I love it. It's a great origin story. I love that your first game was a home brewed game, which is great. I think that, I mean, I don't want to say what is the right and wrong start or even like hint at that, but I think it's really interesting that you were able to start with an experience that was very free form and kind of like didn't leave you trapped by like preconceived first impressions, right? Like I know for some of my friends, like their first game is D&D 5th edition, and it's hard to imagine like what other games could do or like math formulas or like themes or settings or whatever have you.
Yeah, and it's really hard to get people out of that. Like, you have to kind of like drag them in, sit them at a table and go, here, play this game that only uses cards and is about like high school.
It sounds like CIA deprogramming.
It's not Dungeons and Dragons, but it's still fun. All right, great, we did it. Games can be not a D20.
Just not a single D20.
D20s are bad dice, and you can't change my mind.
They're one of the few geometric shapes that don't have, what is it called? It's like a certain term for sides, but it's not perfect probability because the faces don't make the same shapes all the way around the D20. Really? Like there's three different shapes that occur on a D20, so it's not perfect. It's not perfect probability. It's like two or three different combinations of faces make up different shapes.
Weird. Yeah.
Where on like other dice, the shape of the faces are all the same, like for D4 all the way up to D12. But yeah.
D20s are just dumb.
There's a really cool like probability dice video out there from like 12 years ago that I watched about like probability dice math, and go check that out if you want to know what the fuck I'm talking about, because I can't explain it properly. But I just know that D20 is not perfect. It's not the best probability dice.
But I realized like in my early 20s when I started playing games that weren't D&D that like, oh yeah, I started playing games that were roll a D6 and we kind of vibe it out. That's my first game. And so I was never really happy with D&D and the kind of forced structure that it kind of baked you into. So like games I've enjoyed and made sense are way more loosey-goosey. I don't know if OSR means, I don't know what OSR means, but I think OSR seems like my vibe. We played Morkborg for the first time a few weeks ago, and that was like my jam, because you just sort of like, I don't know, roll dice.
Yeah, figure it out, chief.
Damage happens. The GM says stuff. Like, that's the kind of game that I thrive in. I don't want to have to reference the rule book that much. Shadowrun, as much as the game is cool, it is a lot. It's too much.
So much. It's an insane amount of much. Yeah, I think that when I think about story games, I like when sort of the rules can get out of the way. Like, it just has sort of like procedures on top of a couple of like randomly generated outcomes, right? So whether that be deterministic or not, I think when it comes to games like D&D 5th edition or Pathfinder or Shadowrun, right, I look at those games as like not necessarily story games. Like, we put roleplay on top of it because that's sort of like the medium it's engaging with. But I look at them more as like games, like tactical, like I'm playing Fire Emblem. Like, that's how I look at D&D 5th edition or something like that. And I think when it's approached from that lens, I think it's a little bit more satisfying, because you're like, okay, our objective here are to be like the best units. Like, you're not playing an army necessarily, but like, I'm playing the paladin unit.
I was talking to my friend about, like, there was that discourse about 4th edition being the best D&D for a while, and and how, like, I mean, fundamentally it is really good at the combat, like the tactical combat side of things. And he was talking about how his favorite experience with 5th edition was this big, large-scale, mapped-out town siege on Roll20, and they each kind of controlled little squads of people in addition to their ordinary characters. And it got us just down a rabbit hole of, why don't we use D&D's combat system to do campaign-based, tactical, like, miniature wargaming. Like, one of the things I've always wondered, like, Mordheim was a miniature wargame that had a campaign to it, like, your units leveled up and stuff, but, like, I've never been happy with anything that I've found that tries to do that. Just use D&D. 5th edition, start a character at level 5, have three characters at level 1, that's your squad. Every player gets a squad. go do war campaigns and stuff. And then you get to have your 5-hour session or yeah, your 5-hour combats that are just big and splashy. It just seems like a really cool way to use the system for what I would argue it's probably intended to be used for.
Yeah, I mean, that's always up for discussion to whomever is listening to this particular episode. But, it, you know, the other, like a couple weeks ago, me and my partner were playing a game of chess, and I was just thinking, like, you know what? Like, you could put a war story on top of chess. Like, you could say something like, oh, these three pawns, like, the narrative is that they're waiting in, like, trench or something like that with spears. And when the knight comes over, there's another, like, pawn that's protecting all the other pawns. And, like, it's this moment of, like, the knight fell down in the trench and, like, was ambushed, essentially. Or, like, the positioning of your queen, like, she's been plotting the whole time to, like, take out the cleric or bishop, right? It's, like, she keeps maneuvering herself in the court or whatever, and then boom, strikes and takes the bishop, right? Like,
I really like the imagery of like the pawns and soul and knights being like the battlefield, but the queen and the bishops being like diplomatic warfare. Oh, that's really cool. There's something there.
There's juice there, baby. Hashtag juice nation. But yeah. Basically, what I'm alluding to is I think what's the discourse around 5e, the common discourse, is that we always get into a conversation of like, if you're trying to run a heist in D&D, it's not going to work, right? Like that's one of like the common examples. You can't run like murder mystery or heisty stuff with D&D because it doesn't have the tools for that. I mean, it has skill checks, but those are sort of like, yeah, if you took away everything else and just ran skill checks, that's a different game.
You can run D&D. It's just it's not going to be good at it.
Yeah. So I think that if we instead recontextualize the lens and like really leaned into like probably why a lot of people like D&D 4th edition is like it leaned into the fact that it was like a tactics fight game. Whereas like I think 5th edition was trying to capture the story gamer. Right. Or trying to get that audience.
Yeah. Fifth edition was trying to get all the people that abandoned because of fourth edition because that 3.5 was the greatest thing ever made.
Again, up for discussion. I'm not disagreeing with you. I'm just saying here we are and all the fans are like, no, it's second edition.
Yeah.
You know, everyone has their own flavor of D&D they fell in love with, maybe.
The only thing I miss from D&D is making a character that's level 12 or something and having like 30 PDFs and just like patching together this abomination of a character with like, I miss spending 5 hours making a character. That was the game for me. After that, whatever, I'm some half minotaur, half dragon, kobold, nightmare monster because of the stats that it was a power game like number crunching system to teenage Eric Faber.
There's something also about like zooming in on a tactics game, right? Because when you zoom out, you're playing like a heavy tactics game. You have that squadron, right? Or you could even have like a legion, a platoon, a whole army, whatever scale you want to call it. But when you take that elastic scope and you zoom down to like an individual unit, that's potential, or even like squadron level. That's where like the potential of like story really occurs and like the minutiae, right? And it's also about like the different, I think also story is very elastic in scope because the story of a legion is different than the story of like a general or the story of a ragtag set of misfits who disobeyed orders but saved the day anyways, right? Like we see those sorts of war stories all the time in different mediums. So I think if they just leaned into like mechanics that were very like war combat centralized, I think people would figure out how to storytell outside of that and still create really good narratives. I mean, if I'm able to do it with chess, then like anyone's able to do it with a more tactically structured, and people have, right? D&D 4th edition, people played it, people made stories out of it, and like it's certainly possible. So I think it's just 5th edition is trying to do too many things at one time, and that's where they like fight about it.
It's
love to
it's
see
very bloated.
Yeah. And I would love to see a fifth, like two fifth editions, right? I would love to see a fifth edition that did focus on the tactics and a fifth edition that focused on like the theater of the mind or the narrative, right? Like if someone could figure out how to like separate those two things, but it could still have the same like adventure fantasy flavor. I think a lot of people would be really happy with that.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and then at that point, you're just saying, let's make our own adventure fantasy game. Let's make two adventure fantasy games, Jeremy. And then we'll just pitch them at Wizards and see what they do.
That's what, I mean, ultimately that's what Umbral Dive and Astral Journey are, but you know, one day those will come. But anyways, that's not about me. But yeah, I think there's some really interesting, the other piece of sort of your lineage I want to touch on is that you started running Haunted Mansion, but you've done a lot of different styles of LARPs in different, are they called conventions? Am I using the right term? Like thinking about Dystopia Rising and stuff like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, so we have, yeah, and there's DR. I forgot to mention that. Yeah, so they're Dystopia Rising is a like large scale LARP event. That is, it's a national LARP. There are branches across the country. There, if you're on the East Coast, there's probably a branch within a couple hours of you, if not closer. If you're on, if you're in the Midwest, it's a drive to your closest Dystopia Rising branch. I would be a bad ambassador if I didn't say you should go check it out. You can find your local branch on Dystopia Rising's website. It's probably dystopiarisinglarp.com or something like that. But the each branch is run by an independent, like the owner, the director of that game. Mm-hmm. So they all have different vibes. And I've never been outside of Wisconsin's game ever. But you can take your characters to all the different ones. It's like a huge grand scale. Your character levels up, or you get XP and you buy skills, and it's got a big economy. It's kind of like an MMO, but a LARP. Which is wildly different from Haunted Mansion, which is what we were running in the cultural center in my town that was like 3 hours of we designed a new game from the ground up every month using a basic framework. Mm-hmm. And that was more of like, sometimes it was hidden roles and there was like backstabbing and sometimes there was like different tasks you had to achieve. The theme would change every month. The mechanics would overhaul the mechanics and iterate. It was constant iteration. Haunted Mansion is definitely where the bulk of my game design experience comes from, because over the course of 3 years, I designed 35 games of Haunted Mansion.
Whoa.
Something like that. It was a lot. We did a lot of Haunted Mansion. And yeah, so like, what's an example that I can use? One game, what's a game I'm really proud of? Battle Pets is the game that I should talk about. So we've been running Haunted Mansion for years, and at one point, somebody mentioned make Pokemon the Haunted Mansion game. And the Haunted Mansion at its core is just, you put anywhere from 15 to 30 people in a building. Preferably your building is three floors with staircases on either sides and an elevator. We happened to go from one building that was like that at the college to another building that had a very similar layout, so it worked out great. So you have multiple ways to go up and down between the floors, multiple like rooms, so you can do like secret interactions and dealings. You can cordon off different mechanics and different locations. So, and then players would get a role that we wrote, with sometimes a name, sometimes a descriptor, a role, which is a little bio, a little backstory for you to go off of, and then goals. Your primary goal, which is the thing you achieve, you need to do to win, and your secondary goal, which is something else to do to have fun. And then we would, as game runners, we would play the NPCs and run the game and make sure people are doing stuff, but it was all very player-driven. Like, we go solve these puzzles, and you go and have to go interact with the game. We can't really make people have fun at Haunted Mansion. Mm-hmm. We can just provide you the avenue to do it. And it was all free, and we were just volunteering hundreds of hours of our time. But Yeah, Haunted Mansion, we would design it from the ground up every month, and like Battle Pets was me going, I bet I can make Pokemon work. and so like we found a way. It was really, it wasn't our best game, but it was really good example of like how do me and my design partner Matt would sit down and be like, how do you make players that are Pokemon have fun? Like, how do you make somebody who is a monster that has to follow directions of the trainer get to have agency and fun? And so we had to like you give yourself design constraints like that, mm-hmm. and you have to go, okay, well, what if you could be a wild pet or a trained pet, and you can choose whether you want to be wild or captured, and you can go between those two, or you can be a trainer with a pet, or you can be a solo trainer, and like your mechanics of the game operated completely differently based on like what category of trainer or pet you were in, whether you were a duo or whether you were alone. And so we did a lot of wild, weird mechanics with just like, okay, this is the assumption, this is the gimmick, this is the genre. We did a Five Nights at Freddy's game called Three Nights at Teddy, where one of our designers dressed up as a giant animatronic teddy bear and tried to kill people. Yeah, so Haunted Mansion was definitely a lesson in iteration and just giving yourself constraints and trying to figure out how to make it work, and then figuring out how to make sure people were still having fun. Like if Haunted Mansion, you could die. Like you could, there were knives and Nerf guns, little foam knives and Nerf guns. And you people could die, so you had to figure out how to make sure when you died, you still got to engage and play the game.
Right.
So, like, if you die, you went down to our NPC monster camp, where we would suit you up and run you out as NPCs, monsters, whatever, to help engage the other players that are still alive. And so some people liked that more. That's a thing we took kind of from Dystopia Rising, because, like, you have to spend 4 hours of your weekend as an NPC at DR, just because otherwise you don't have zombies in the zombie game.
Right.
If you don't have people volunteering. And some people just love that way more than playing. So I don't know, I'm rambling at this point, but.
Not at all.
I think that answered a question.
Yeah, it's fascinating. I mean, you've listened to the show, but there was a point in time where me and my siblings would pretend to be Pokemon and Pokemon trainers for a very long time.
Probably, oh, yeah.
Probably up until, I think until we were about 14 or so, 14 or 15 maybe. When did I live in that house? Yeah, probably about 14. And, you know, two of us would be the trainer, two of us would be the Pokemon, I'd yell flamethrower, and one of my siblings would roar, and there would be a flamethrower that's coming out the mouth, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah, we hands. We gamified that. We had little foam like basketballs and little foam soccer balls that were like your various Pokemon attacks and Pokeballs to capture Pokemon. And like we had arenas that were like, this is the gym, this is where you're allowed to battle. And then we had people, we had just adults like this is a game where some people from DR and like one of my friend's dad, who's like 50 or whatever, came to visit, and he LARPs. He played Vampire and stuff, so he came to Haunted Mansion to see what we were doing, and it happened to be Battle Pets. And so we just had these, like, grown adult people dressed as Pokemon and trainers kind of dancing around chucking foam balls at each other. And that is, like, peak. There's pictures of it up on our website from Haunted Mansion. It is quality. That's what I live for. I want to make people do absurd things for the sake of games.
For the sake of fun.
Yes, for the sake of fun. Just be ridiculous. It is so fun to be ridiculous.
I think it's amazing. Well, with all of that, I think this is a wonderful time to transition into, you know, one of your more recent projects in the tabletop role-playing game space. Let's talk about Noble Core.
Yeah.
Yeah, bit,
on the topic of be ridiculous, Noble Core, Fate of the Shattered Galaxy exists.
That's the you have to say the full thing.
Noble Core now auto corrects to all caps in my phone keyboard because whenever I type it, I make it all caps, and now that's just how it's artistically presented as Noble Core in all caps.
Well, so would you just give a brief introduction of what Noble Core is, Eric, for those who may not have read it yet?
Yeah, Noble Core is a where's my description? It's a epic power metal science fantasy game where you are heroes from across the galaxy working to save the galaxy from the evil of Zarthanax. It is a super lightweight little game that I just fever dreamed into existence because I'd been like thinking about doing something. I spent a good part of 2020 listening to just Glory Hammer. It was like the top of my Spotify Wrapped for 2020 because I was just depressed and didn't have anything to do after COVID stopped us from running Haunted Mansion, and I hosted Trivia Weekly. I went from being very busy to having absolutely nothing to do. So, you know, 2020 was a bad year for everyone. I listened to Noble Core to get energy and be psyched. Or I listened to Glory Hammer. And I always had this idea of making a game or running a game that was kind of in that surreal, absurd, over-the-top science fantasy setting with, like, legendary enchanted jetpacks and just super silly stuff that is self-aware of how silly it is, but not, like, inherently comedic. And so I started listening to this podcast and went, wow, you can just write games and put them on itch. That's great. I'm gonna just do that. And I wrote this game in like 2 days. and it's great. It slaps. It is. It's got a lot of it bleeds juice. It just bleeds energy.
Yes, I totally agree. One of the first things that really got me about Noble Core is sort of like the presentation of the reference document coming from the Noble Core protocol computer. I think that's amazing. It really taps into a conversation I have with some friends about like how do we write games so it's just not like a dry reference document, or like there's a conversation a while back about like what is the voice of your game, right? And I think this is just oozing with voice. Like, I think you found the perfect in its presentation. For anyone who's not seen or read the book, there's like a sort of like a light green. Imagine the fucking
it's a command prompt.
It's a command prompt. Yes, thank you.
It's a terminal computer from the Fallout games. That is the look.
It's so good. It's so good. Another thing, and I don't know if you meant to do this, but I also get some vibes of like sort of like Voltron / Masters of the Universe kind of feel.
Masters of the Universe. Yeah. Also fantastic point of reference. Yeah. We just played it the other day. I actually just play tested it for the first time on Saturday. It was the first time I got to play this game. And Kung Fury, if you've seen that movie, that it's a lot of that energy. One of my friends played basically Hackerman from the Kung Fury with like the Nintendo Power Gloves as their relic. Yeah, it's a lot of that. And like I don't know what else to say other than like you're encouraged to make stuff very specific and not necessarily grounded at all. Like it's got a lot of vibe.
It's very like specifically high concept pieces. Like it's just it's God. And so you were talking about how there was a sort of fever dream, but what was like the sparking idea for this? Was it the music that was sort of like putting you in the space? Did you watch something? Like, how did this come into the fever dream mode?
Yeah, so 2020, I listened to a lot of Glory Hammer. I got super into just Glory Hammer because I love that people dress up as characters in a absurd, like, sci-fi science fantasy setting and sing about it. Like, they have a song called The Legendary Enchanted Jetpack, and that is great. That is so good. That is not, I unironically adore the energy and passion that, like, the epic power metal bands put into that aesthetic, because it they obviously are taking it seriously and care and put it work into it, but they're self-aware. They know it's ridiculous. They're dressed in fantasy armor. It's called The Legendary Enchanted Jetpack. It's silly, but it's like silly with intent and without being satirical, I guess.
Yeah. Good word.
And so I was playing RPGs, as you do, and I was talking to one of my friends. I was like, man, I really want to run a game that's just got that energy in it. And so it was just in the back of my mind for a while, the setting and wanting to run a game like that. And then, I always just sort of had that in the back of my head. I listened to a lot of Glory Hammer still. I put together a playlist of more bands also. And then I was just working on, I just like made a document and kind of just wrote it. Like it stemmed from it stemmed from a few different projects that I've been working on and off of over the past couple of years. Mm-hmm. My friend Quinn, who I would like to get to do like some layout and art for this game because they are incredible at that stuff. They did all the design for Haunted Mansion art, and they designed a game that was used a lot of mechanics this kind of evolved from. I had a game that was a very simple D6 system that this was originally gonna be using, and then I went, nah, I want dice rolls to be hype. So let's add more dice and make them explode. And so it kind of grew from that like system that was very simple. Like, pick a skill. That's your skill now. Pick a thing and you're good at that. And we grew. It just kind of grew from that as I wrote it. Yeah.
I am envious of that for sure, that like sort of just the font of creation you were able to drink from it through Glory Hammer and come into its full existence in such a short amount of time, which is really awesome. But you also have, and not to just harp on like saying, oh, like Eric is very gifted or talented, but like you also have a lot of creative writing over the course of the last several years because of all, I know you write a ton for, like you said, you did the iterations experimentation, all of the Haunted Mansion gatherings and adventures, and you're kind of constantly in a creative writing state. So it's amazing that your skill allowed you to attain something in such a short amount of time. And once you had like a huge idea around it.
I'm jealous of me too, because I have another project that is not going very far because once you get past that initial like hyper-focus energy of just like, oh, this is great. And then you write it. Game design is hard.
Yeah.
It's really hard to maintain.
Game design really is hard.
It is. It's very difficult. It's really hard to maintain that. I'm fortunate that this kind of came out in a couple of days and like just patched together into this because and it's very simple. Like, it's not mechanically complex. It's mostly me trying to fit as many goofy words into the rules text as possible. Like,
succeeded.
I and also Yeah, and that helped me write a lot of it too. Is like, I do a lot of writing, like short stories and creative writing. I have a writer's workshop that we've been meeting once a month for a few years now. Uh-huh. And so I do a lot of writing on just for fun. And so that helps kind of just gives you momentum gives me momentum, I guess. Cause mm-hmm, like mm-hmm. if I'm writing narrative in the rules, it is a lot more fun and a lot less dry than mm-hmm. going, I need to fill out this table with stuff. So you go, like, what's a line from this that's super fun? The Noble Core Protocol has selected you to take on the role of the galaxy's hero. Like, this is rules text, but it's written from the voice of the Noble Core Protocol, which is
Fallout commercials.
Yeah, it's amorphous computer program that has, like, detected and I think Energies of Anti-Chaos is written in here. Like, you are a hero, and the Noble Core is telling you how to do it good. And it just because of how goofy and fun and over the top this was to write, it was a lot easier to maintain that momentum for sure.
But I also think it's a good showcase of like we talked about with the tactic stuff for D&D about like really like saying what this is and just like having the fun of like going all in on that sort of singular idea, because then I think it creates something so much more resonant and also something so much more, I feel like the ideas come together so much better when you're like, this is the singular thing that I'm trying to do. This Noble Core is fun and fictiony, and the mechanics sort of get out of the way because you're really counting successes versus failures in the system, and there's explosion dice, so that's like your epic critical moments, so you have like all these fun bits, but you're still never really sure where success ends until all the dice stop rolling, which is crazy. Oh yeah,
which is, we learned over the weekend when we played it, is great. It's super fun. Stand by the mechanic. It's super swingy. And exploding dice are like both exciting and horrible at the same time, because they have a chance of just counteracting themselves. So like you see sixes and you're like, oh no, hopefully these aren't ones when we re-roll them.
Yeah. Oh, that's so good.
Yeah, it was great. We also, if I was going to change anything after that playtest, I would add we made the spaceship a character, like we just followed character creation for the spaceship that the team had as a group, and that was great. Like, we made the spaceship its own character in the party, and that like added a lot. There's a lot of emergent world building from the character creation process that allowed I don't like prep. I'm a bad GM that doesn't want to have to work on anything before I sit down at the table. I would rather just have, kind of spitball and vibe it out as we play. And this game just, the players do all the world building for you, and then you just sort of use keywords from their character sheets and from the galaxy creation stuff.
I was going to say, oh shit, what was I going to say? Oh, the ship as character makes me think a lot about, I don't know if you're familiar with this anime, but it's called Outlaw Star. And
I'm not familiar with many animes. Oh, but this, okay, during my walk this morning while I was thinking about this interview, I realized that this game would probably make a hype anime-like system.
Yeah, yeah.
Just big, over-the-top Dragon Ball Z nonsense.
Yeah, yeah.
Somebody write that hack, Jeremy. Hack the game.
Make the shonen. The Noble Core Shonen. Shonen Core.
There you go. Shonen Core. Do it.
But in Outlaw Star, the ship has sort of like a personality to it. It's an AI. And the ship fights like it has humanoid arms that detach from it. They're called grappler arms. And
heck yeah.
They hold. It's so funny because the idea is that like you have star fighting combat where it's basically ships sumo wrestling each other, and like it's, you know, you could have a ship that has lasers, but instead you have a ship that has grappler arms and pulls out its own small SMG and like a Bowie knife.
Hell yeah, I love it. That's so fucking cool.
In space.
Oh, that is ridiculous. That's the kind of dumb stuff I love. Like our spaceship. I've got the note cards right here. So its title was The Last Organic Ship. And so we just extrapolated that to mean it was like it's a parasitic species that overtake other vessels and makes them into spaceships. Mm-hmm. And so it was just this like bulbous mass of flesh in space. Mm-hmm. And its weapon had a giant space trebuchet.
How does it even work?
Who cares? We had a like some of the best stuff. These note cards are great. Like extrapolating from character creation to like add world building elements to the setting is so much fun. I love doing that just in general. Like games should do that. But we had like one of the characters was a whole school of space fish. Mm-hmm. We had just some really silly stuff. Fire breathing space unicorns is written down somewhere.
But also amazing.
Yeah, it's great. I love it. Anyway. Yeah. Anyway. Spaceships as a character. I think that's a part of space nautical fiction is like the ship is a character. It's a thing in Firefly also. The ship is a character. So and it mechanically adds a lot to the game. So
I love it. Again, iteration upon iteration in a fast, rapid environment. It's pretty good.
It's good. Iteration is how you get good at things and create good things. Because your first iteration is bad.
Good. Yeah.
first drafts are bad, usually, in my experience.
You have a lot of game writing sort of pedigree about you, but you said that one of the topics you kind of want to get into the show is like coming into the industry and stuff like that. I assume meaning the tabletop role-playing game space. So what has been your experience so far in creating tabletop role-playing games recently?
Well, I made Noble Core a month ago, and post about it on Twitter sometimes, and I think it's got like 5 downloads.
Nice.
And I think it's mostly like getting into any industry. Tabletop role-playing game has been better than board games for sure. That's a nightmare. But like it's like being any creative on the internet is about just having people find out you exist. And the tabletop RPG community online has been way better about that than most stuff, because there's just like people constantly talking. I think game designers like talking about games a lot. So they tend to want to talk to you about that, and they tend to want to share cool things they find about that. I just don't.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
I don't know. You are working on games, Jeremy, and
yes,
and you've been doing this podcast for what, like a year?
Yeah, the anniversary is coming up in like 2 weeks or something like that, per the recording of this episode.
Yeah, how is your journey through the tabletop RPG industry going? Having not you're a pillar of the community now, or a pillar of a community at least.
I'm gonna throw up from blushing. Thanks for turning the question back on me. It's been a treat to meet a ton of people, and I think something I've discovered about myself in my want to be a game designer is that I think it's the same sort of concepts we have about the supply and demand of game masters for games, right? Tons of players, not a lot of game masters. So it's hard to facilitate games. It's hard to get someone who's going to read your book front to back and figure out how to get people engaged and parse out the information of your system. You know, often on this show, I accredit people to being hardware computers and games are software, and not every software works with every operating system, and not every computer speaks well to the other computer sometimes. And so I guess what this is all sort of circling is that I started this show to become a game designer. I wanted to learn from a bunch of people and get their insights so that I wouldn't have to go to college for game theory or some bullshit like that. And I guess not that game theory college is bad. Sorry for anyone I may have offended with that. I don't mean it to be offensive, but I can't afford to go back to college, right? And I also can't afford to go back to college for 4 years. And I also think there's something very valuable in mentorship. So I just make every guest my mentor, essentially. And what I've come to discover is that I think there are so many game authors out there, and game authors more support staff members. So support staff members in this case are the GMs that have a high demand for, you know, publishers, editors, press, mother effing, visual layouts, artists, illustrators, you know,
there's printers. There's a lot of stuff outside of the game design process that,
right?
That needs
some attention. And I think as this show continues to evolve into sort of looking at the business of game design, it's also about learning about how to build a business out of being a game author or any of those support members, and how to connect with people and network and communicate and project manage. God, project management is a fucking huge one. And that doesn't even cover the actual play spectrum of the industry, where that is also press content for your game with actors, the GMs in those games, directors of those projects, all the asset builders, graphic designers, the stream engineers, right? There's a lot of hands that go into the success of a game. I mean, I would like to attribute D&D's success in the media that has it, right? Stranger Things was a really big stepping stone for them in terms of its ratings and how it connected to those elements. There have been many other cartoons that have been using a classic dungeon. I remember there's an episode in the newer Voltron animated series where they have like a whole D&D episode. And that's part of its success, is that it gets kind of drip fed into a lot of different nerd culture phenomenon, and even some like non nerd culture stuff. And so I think that a lot more indie games would be a little bit more successful. That's not necessarily true. I think that part of the thing that we're missing is just like the support. Like, I think there's a bigger community that could come together in terms of the game design culture, and not just like tabletop games, but even like board games, LARPs, video games. I mean, video games get a huge amount of coverage with like Let's Plays and stuff, right? So
yeah, Twitch streaming. Twitch streaming alone.
Yeah, has really been like a bolster for the games industry, and showcasing like every single like kid or adult or person that wants to become a Let's Play streamer, they have to buy a game to do that, right? Albeit any piracy things, but like, you have to buy Darkest Dungeon 2, which is like really big on my YouTube search stuff, and like Fire Emblem, Three Kingdoms, or is that what it's called? I don't remember. Three Houses, I think is what it's called. You know, the new Final Fantasy VII remake that came out, a lot of people were streaming and doing stuff on. So, like, that all converts into the business of game design. So I think if there was just, like, people who were willing to support, but also we have to make sure that we take care of those people that are supporting our games, right? I think something else to consider is that, like, when people make a game, they budget for the visual layout person, they budget for the artist, they budget for the editor, but no one really like budgets for the press, which is one of the, like, key components for getting your game out there, or actual play people, right? Like, not a lot of people are expecting to pay actual play actors to showcase their game, especially when you're trying to do like a marketing campaign for it. So I still think there are some conversations about like, how do we ultimately, this is all to say that like, I think there is room for people to express themselves in a support manner in games, rather than trying to figure out how to make it in the industry by making a game. Right. And I'm not saying that's overly saturated. I'm just saying like, if creative writing is not your thing, but editing is, fucking do that. There's so many indie games that maybe kind of need an editor or someone who's like really good at copywriting and like can bring out the most. I'm not saying that's Noblecore, because Noblecore is great fiction narrative built into the rules, but you know, it's, I think there's opportunities in places that aren't the obvious, is basically what I'm alluding to. And that's how it's been for me. I've been discovering that like, I don't really like writing mechanics. I like writing fiction. So I like writing settings. I like to make adventures. Like, that's my thing. I don't really want to like explore dice math and stuff.
Yeah, I couldn't tell you the statistics on these dice in Noblecore. Let me tell you that. I opened up any dice and I spent like a few hours trying to figure out how to code this into that, and I couldn't. So I decided I didn't care. It's fun. Yeah, I think that's the part of my approach. Like, I like when I found Itch a year ago or whatever, and I went, wow, you can just put games on the internet. That's cool. That's great. That I like, it felt more approachable than any other creative industry I've engaged with. Mm-hmm. Running Haunted Mansion has always been like a creative outlet, and I had 15 to 30 people show up every month and tell me my game was sweet. And that is the dopamine that I needed. and it's harder to get that with things you post on the internet. And it's hard to get eyes on it because you don't have people showing up to play your game with you. So, like, Itch is a really great tool to get it out there, but then you need to get people to find it. Mm-hmm. And you need to, like, networking is one of the parts. Like, I'm just trying to meet people now. Just, like, to meet the industry and, like, find other people and their cool games and projects. But yeah, it's like, it seems overwhelming to approach the industry, any industry, and go, yeah, I want to be a part of that. Especially like the internet makes it so like the industry feels like this massive conglomerate of people who have made it. But those are just the people I happen to follow on Twitter.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's like, I'm overwhelmed by the concept of trying to make people play my games. And so I like what you're doing here. This is great because it's just like a way to find new games and find new people that make games. And like the Discord for your DYD Discord has been cool for that, because the Brain Trust Discord has a lot of people in it, and that's even more overwhelming.
Yeah.
I don't know. I feel like I'm just overwhelmed by the sheer quantity of other people, and I'm bad at interacting with people on the internet. So,
and like the sheer quantity of like game designers, right? Like, I think that's a really big part of it. Everyone's like making a game in, I guess, in the vacuum of these two spaces. Like, no one's really like doing, like, talking about support work style stuff. There are a couple publishers in Brain Trust, like Floating Chair. I know that. Oh, shit. Who else is in there? I think Spear Witch is in there, maybe. Yeah, I think Spear Witch is in there. And then one of the Exalted Funeral people might be in there. But I could totally be wrong. But, they're all talking about, like, hey, you know, these are some mechanics I've been moving about around. Then everyone has, like, a conversation about mechanics. And, you know, I've been thinking about, like, what is play? And then everyone has a conversation about what is play. And these are all very, like, philosophical questions around the concept of game writing. And I think, in tandem with yours and what I was trying to say before, but I lost my way, but here it is like, you can be a part of any industry in a lot of different ways that are maybe more suited to your personal strengths when you think about helping the greater community overall, right? If not everyone wants to be an editor for games, then you can be, if that's your jam, you can be an editor for games. I know that's how Vi Huntsman, I'm a Waffle Bunny on Twitter, has gotten into the industry, along with being a little bit of press as well. They have a YouTube channel called Collaborations Without Permission, but they also just do editing. They don't really like write games, but they help support the industry by talking about games they're really interested in and getting work as editor for different projects. And they are in the game industry. They're just not the one writing the game. And I think that's totally okay. And I think that's something to be aware of when you sort of like first come in here and everyone's like, you know, buy my game, check out my game, here's community copies of my game. Or talking about like PBTA mechanics. What does it mean to be a PBTA game? And like, you don't have to, I mean, it's cool if you engage those things, but like, that doesn't have to be the lens that you work in the industry. And like, I mentioned a ton of jobs before that you could easily do and like get paid for if you wanted to as well.
Yeah. And I mean, like, part of my experience running Haunted Mansion was running, like, organizing a team of four people to write that, post social media, like that kind of stuff. But I've always interacted, like, that's the other thing, coming from LARP, you interact with such a small scale of the world. Like, I had my small town of 8,000 people and that was our population to interact with. So we didn't really have the ability to go further than that. And like, you need a team of people to make something happen. I mean, you can do it from the ground up by yourself. It's a lot of work. I'm bad at art. Visual art is not my forte at all. So like, but artists cost money. Like, it feels like you need a team of people to get together to do something. And I have no experience with that. And seeing all these really talented people doing that on the internet is so cool and so daunting for me, at least. Like, I just see it, I'm like, yeah, that's cool. I'm gonna gonna go back to running my little game in my house.
I mean, I think about when you talk about that, I think about people like Spencer Campbell, I think about Tony Vicinda, I think about all the crew over at Hutopia. I think about how Exalted Funeral puts projects together. And just all those people I've mentioned are like really good at bringing together people around. I mean, Tony Facenda and Marcus with Down We Go, Spencer Campbell with the Slayer's Almanac Atlas that's being worked on right now, in addition to all of like the Nova collaborations and Hutopia for putting on wonderfully diverse actual plays on the regular, and so many other people that I probably haven't mentioned or don't know are also doing very similar things when they think about how to collaborate on projects. And that's just to like sort of piggyback on what you were saying in terms of like, it takes a team to really like really crush out a thing or a long like individual pedigree that also helps the long division of your work, right? Like showing your work to the final point, your portfolio, if one might say that.
Yeah. My friend Quinn has a publishing company. They started back during quarantine, and they Codex Borealis Publishing.com, I believe, plug. And they're putting together like a zine, a quarterly zine that I have a game coming out in next, probably first quarter next year, I think. That, but basically they're just sourcing artists to try to like put a bunch of different stuff into like a niche art zine. And I'm really like, that's so cool. I'm really like jealous of the drive to like, I'm sure if I put my mind to it, my experience with Haunted Mansion and stuff, I'm pretty good at project management and running projects, but like, that's so cool to just go, I just want to showcase other people's stuff in this book. And like, I think that kind of work is really cool. And I want to kind of, maybe I'll start looking at more ways to do that kind of thing. Just get people together. That's one of the things that I don't know how to do. I'm bad at meeting new people, Jeremy.
Well, you've been doing a great job here today and over on the Discord server, so.
Yeah, maybe not the Discord's been great. Yeah, maybe not. All right.
I think that's going to bring us to the top of the show here. Eric, thank you so much for being here today. I really appreciate you taking the time to hang out with me and talk to everyone who's listening. And would you just give a brief outro once again of like who you are, how people can get in touch with you, how people can get Noble Core and stuff like that. All of these links that Eric will be providing will be down below in the show notes for your access.
Yeah, I'm Eric Faber. I'm at Airborne Ham on Twitter, Airborne with an E at the end, and airborneham.itch.io. That's where you can get Noble Core. It's $8. And yeah, you can say hi to me so that I don't have to reach out to you because that's stressful.
Aw, thank you everyone for hanging out with us. I learned a lot from Eric today. I hope you did too. And we'll catch you on the next episode. Say bye to the people, Eric.
Bye bye.
Hey there, listeners. Thank you very much for taking the time to sit down and hang out with Eric and I. We really appreciate it. You can find links and resources below in the show notes for getting in touch with Eric and other content with similar topics. Support Jeremy and the DYD podcast by reviewing the show, joining the community Discord server, and donating either on Patreon or Ko-Fi. Thanks again for listening, and remember that design is a marathon, so enjoy the journey and have a great day.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, folks, it's Mark Maron from WTF. I've been talking to all kinds of famous people in my garage since 2009, including a sitting president.
You know, I don't imagine you were flying in here on the chopper thinking like, you know, I am nervous about Mark.
No, I wasn't.
Okay, well, that's good.
That would be a problem.
It would be a problem.
If the president was feeling stressed about
coming to my garage.
Coming to your garage.
And now there's even more WTF when you subscribe to the full Marin to get weekly bonus content and all WTF episodes ad-free. Listen to WTF wherever you get podcasts and subscribe to the full Marin at go.acast.com/WTF.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.